Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Surprise you me, honey, but you'll never understand the calluses that are behind your man's wedding band. Take it, Jimmy. The calluses that are behind your man's wedding band.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Justin McGoldrick? Y'all like Justin? Justin McGoldrick is a self-taught singer, songwriter, and musician originally from Southern Australia. He performs solo and with his band, the P47s. Find more information at justinmcgoldrick.com, Facebook, or Reverb Nation. His album, Calliope Blues, is available on iTunes, Amazon, and Spotify, and available after the show tonight. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. A native Arkansan, Mark has played and shared the stage with many blues legends, including Robert Jr. Lockwood. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Our featured artist tonight is Little Rock painter Doug Norton with his two JFK paintings right here, both of which are for sale. Our listeners can find out more about Doug and this artwork at talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? This week, our show is about witnessing history and coincides with JFK 50 Years Later, a photography exhibit showing at 8 venues throughout the Argenta Arts District that features rarely and never before seen images from the largest JFK archive in the world. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, George Smith is at Dealey Plaza in Dallas on November 22, 1963. And we'll end the night with Kay Fisher 3 days later at the Capitol Rotunda as she waits in line to touch history. But let's start the night with J.B. Hogan 1,000 miles away and a radio announcement that shook his world in Walk On.
I was coming out of humanities class at Imperial Valley Junior College in far Southern California when my friend Mike came running up. He was breathless because he'd been going from building to building looking for me. He had made two passes through the PAC Student Union where dozens of students were crowding around a radio someone had hooked up on one of the tables just outside the cafeteria. "Hey," he cried out. I looked around, spotted him running towards me and waved. "What's going on, Mike?" I said as he rushed up. "Did you hear the news?" "What news?" I said with a grin. I felt a ribbing coming on. Mike loved to make up stuff and try to trick you into believing it. He had a comic, practical joker side to his nature. "The president's been shot." It didn't sound like one of his jokes to me this time. My smile disappeared. "That's not funny, Mike," I said. "What are you talking about?" "It's on the radio," he explained. "Somebody shot President Kennedy down in Texas." "Mike," I said, pointing a finger at my friend, "if this is some kind of joke, I don't think it's very cool." "I swear to you," he insisted, "you can hear for yourself over at the Union." "You're kidding me." "Come on, buddy," Mike said. "There's a bunch already over there. It's being broadcast live." "Who shot him?" I asked as we hurried to the Union. "They don't know," Mike answered, "but a bunch of shots were fired, I think." At the Union, we found an ever-growing group of students collecting around the radio. There were a lot of low, excited conversations going on among the crowd until someone called for silence. "Quiet, everybody. Listen," the person said. "Listen, please." We all shoved closer to the radio to hear the news report. "Doctors at Parkland Memorial Hospital in Dallas, Texas," the newsman said, his voice crackling over the airwaves, "have just announced that President Kennedy died from gunshot wounds at 1:33 p.m. local time. I repeat, the President of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, is dead." It became completely quiet there by the radio in the Union. Mike and I looked at each other without speaking. A few people began to cry. The news report continued live from Dallas. No one went to class. "The Lord works in mysterious ways," Reverend Martin, pastor of our non-denominational community church, told the crowd of mourners. "He has seen fit to take this great man from us, this beacon of light in the darkness of the modern world. But we mustn't let grief fill us with remorse and despair. God is merciful and just, though his purpose may not always be clear." As Reverend Martin continued his memorial sermon, I sat in the back pew trying to make sense of what had happened and wondering what it all meant. The Reverend was trying to make the President's death seem all right somehow. Mysterious ways, I thought. I didn't get that. Didn't understand it. It was too strange, too scary. And that whole Dallas thing was just plain crazy. JFK killed. What purpose did that serve? He was just riding along and then boom, his head and throat were blown away. The Secret Service guy jumping on the back of the car and everything else that had happened that horrible weekend. How was all that supposed to be okay somehow? What did it say about us as a country? To me, Dallas seemed like Dodge City from the movies or something. The president is shot down, then the killer murdered too on live television. I had worked over the weekend and missed Oswald's televised assassination. It was all nuts to me, like some kind of Wild West shootout or something. This can't happen here, I thought, not nowadays. Maybe when Lincoln died 100 years ago, but not now. This was the 20th century. This was the here and now. "May the Lord bless each and every one of you," Reverend Martin was saying, his closing remarks bringing me back into the outer world. "In the name of Jesus Christ, amen." "Amen," the crowd responded. "I'm glad that's over," I told myself as I rose with the others to leave. "I have to get out of here. I need some air." Outside, I ran into a high school buddy who'd worked with me and some of the other boys out in the fields at the beginning of last summer. Hadn't seen him for a while. "What you say?" he asked in greeting. "How you doing, Jim?" I rejoined. We stood at the side of the church for a few moments, mostly looking at the ground. "It's bad, ain't it?" he finally said. "Yeah," I agreed. "It sure is." "It don't seem possible, you know," he said doubtfully. I nodded. "Did you see Oswald?" "No," I told him. "I was working out at Mrs. Korn's." There was another long, awkward pause as we struggled to find adequate words for the moment. "Well," I finally said, "I guess I better get going." "Yeah, I'll see you," Jim said, beginning to walk away himself. "Be cool now." "You too," I replied. "Take it easy." I actually lingered there by the church for a few minutes more, then walked across the street. From the new vantage point, I looked back and saw Reverend Martin on the edge of the church lawn. He was turning back to the chapel now, but it looked like he had been walking towards me. I waited and watched him go up the sidewalk to the church. Then I turned and headed down the street, away from the church. After a few steps, I heard the door slam shut behind me. They made a surprisingly loud noise, probably because there was no one left inside. The sound kind of startled me, and I jumped a bit, reflexively. It was an empty, hollow sound, but one that pulled on you just the same. I took a long, deep breath and exhaled. There was just the slightest hint of fall in the desert air. I smiled grimly to myself and walked on down the street.
J.B. Hogan has over 200 publications in such journals as Cynic Online Magazine and Dead Mule. His book, The Apostate, is available from Pen L Publishing and on Amazon.com. He lives in Fayetteville, Arkansas. In our next story, George Smith turns his car around and drives into history in The Day Hope Died.
The news splattered around my car as the DJ from Dallas's radio station KLIF brought the news. I was less than 50 miles east of Dallas, along with two carpoolers, listening to events unfolding in Dallas following the shooting. Shots fired in Dealey Plaza. President Kennedy reportedly shot. Witnesses say the shot came from a building in Dealey Plaza. The presidential motorcade is en route to Parkland Hospital. Police are scouring the Texas Book Depository building from where the shots were thought to have originated. The inside of the president's limousine is covered in blood from what has been reported as a head wound. President John F. Kennedy, the 35th president of the United States, is dead. Dead? Dead. He couldn't be dead. He was the first president that I considered my president, even though I'd been too young to vote for him. Kennedy was Catholic, the only one I knew from my cloistered Southern Baptist world. But at 18 years old, that didn't bother me, except if the Pope started giving him orders on how to be president, which my mother and father predicted would happen. Now, if that Pope gave our president orders, that would bother me. But in 9 months of being president, there had not been one inkling of Pope messing, and his stock with the American people was rising exponentially. Ike was the first president I really remembered. He had had a goofy grin, was bald, reminded me of my grandfather, and played golf. Kennedy had an abundance of hair and a soothing smile, and had this habit of pushing his thick hair off his forehead in a boyish way. He was my president. I pulled over to the side of the road just outside Cooper, Texas, and started crying. It was past noon on this clear, late November day, and despite my two passengers, I sat there in shock, bawling and beating on the steering wheel. His announced visit to Dallas that day, less than 50 miles from East Texas State College, where I was trying to figure out what to do with my life, had me intent on cutting chemistry, English, and history and catching a glimpse of real history. But that darn D in chemistry that needed to be raised to a C won out, and Magnolia, my green-on-green 64 Corvair, stayed close to home. Through a veil of tears, I dropped off the carpoolers and turned my car around and headed west toward Dallas, toward Dealey Plaza. I drove fast but didn't think about a ticket and never saw a single state trooper on the drive into the city. By 1:50, I was several blocks from the north side of Dealey Plaza and parked behind a small office building. Everything your business needs to be successful. Walking toward Dealey Plaza, I was stopped 3 times by police and told the plaza was closed. Each time, I reversed my course, hit the next alley, and tried again at the next street. The fourth time, I managed to slip by a policeman and had two men leaning against a 61 Olds, and he was frisking them very slowly. The view of Dealey Plaza from its northeast corner was shocking. Police were everywhere, some on their hands and knees on the grassy area just east and north of the underpass. Other suited men leaned out of various windows at the Texas Book Depository, gesturing, pointing. I walked toward a small grassy hill and heard a man being questioned by a policeman. He stated emphatically, "A shot came from there," pointing at the building, "and another there," pointing to a wall and a small stand of trees at the top of a small hill. A woman was sitting on the curb, her feet out in the street. Her hands covered her face, which was buried into her knees. She looked up, her eye makeup, two tracks of black mascara as it ran down her face. "Why?" She cocked her head as if waiting for an answer. "Why?" She put her face back in the crook of her knees. I walked south on Houston Street to Main and turned west. In a break of the line of policemen standing, guarding something, I walked through. I cut across a large, grassy, park-like area toward the book depository. A policeman stopped me halfway across. "That's it, bub. Stop right there and turn around and take a hike." I looked at him, and fresh tears started flowing. "Please, I just need to be here, now, today." He stared mean at me and then rubbed a rough red hand over his face. "Say on this side of the area, don't go to the Elm Street roadway. They're still processing that area." Then he turned his back and stood there, shoulders bowed, head down. I took a couple of steps towards Elm, the street where the president was shot, and stopped when I saw a man in a dark suit bend over and stare intently at the ground. He reached in his coat pocket and pulled out a small pair of tweezers and a glassine envelope. He tweezered something small from the curb and placed it gently in the envelope. I wanted to ask him what it was, but I didn't want to know the answer. Somewhere in the logical part of my brain, I knew I had seen enough. An hour later, I was outside of Dallas heading home to Cooper. The radio went through a number of tunes. Sugar Shack, Puff the Magic Dragon, and then Skeeter Davis blasted out her rendition, "It's the End of the World." For the second time that day, I pulled over the side of the road and I stared out the window as an empty field and thought for the 100th time, is the world over? Is my world over? Is the world of hope and happiness and Camelot really gone? Skeeter wailed her last line, the DJ again announced that the president, John F. Kennedy, was dead. Without any introduction, he started the next record. It was the Impressions hit, "It's All Right." It was the wrong record at the wrong time. In my world, which at that moment was crumbling around me, it was never going to be all right again. Never, ever again.
George Smith is a former newspaper editor and publisher and corporate communications executive. He has had 6 books published and has 5 more in the works. He believes that an entire generation lost its collective innocence the day JFK died. In our final story of the night, Kay Fisher's brush with history is both literal and unforgettable in A Private Goodbye.
I guess we thought we were the only people going to see the President of the United States on November 25th, 1963, lying in state in the Capitol Rotunda in Washington, D.C. Instead, we ran smack into a non-ending line of people and were told it would be at least 5 to 6 hours to work our way up to the entrance of the rotunda. I was 8 and a half months pregnant. For 2 days, my husband Bob, our 2 best friends, and I have been glued to the TV in our tiny New York City apartment, first to watch the parade in Dallas, and then in disbelief at the news of the shooting, the shots being tracked to the book depository, and then doctors from Parkland Hospital explaining that the president was dead. When we saw the dignitaries file past the casket of our president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, we couldn't bear to not be there to say goodbye to our hero. So at noon that day, with no money, no luggage, and no place to stay, the 4 of us squished into our blue Volkswagen Bug convertible and headed to Washington. Bob drove as fast as our little car could take us, and we raced into D.C. in under 4 hours. None of us knew our way around or how to get to the rotunda, and there was the issue of where to stay. We were somewhere in downtown when all of a sudden, Bob slammed on the brakes and turned the car around in the middle of bumper-to-bumper traffic, pulled over to the curb in front of a hotel, and ran inside the lobby. It turned out to be one of the finest hotels in town and was in walking distance of the Capitol. Bob quickly came out, beaming like a Cheshire cat, and exclaimed that the hotel had 1 room left and it had 2 double beds. We couldn't believe our luck. Of course, we took it, grabbed the keys, and left on foot for the rotunda. Details like how we were going to pay for the room would have to come later. On the Capitol grounds, we got in line. By this time, it was around 4 p.m., and none of us had eaten lunch that day. But food was the last thing on our minds, including mine, even though I was eating for 2. It quickly became evident that once you were in line, there was no going anywhere, especially not even the bathroom. And we weren't in any position to pay to move up faster, though we saw others do it. We were either going to wait in line or our husbands would be beaten to the ground for cutting in. It just wasn't done. It was 1963, and we behaved. There was no pushing, no yelling, no sound. It was all quiet and very reverent. We began to chat with people in front and in back of us, and we came from everywhere, all states, all sizes, all makes. There was a group of nuns in their habits in front of us, and not being Catholic, we brazenly asked all sorts of questions about how they thought their church would react to losing President Kennedy. Once they learned I was from the Deep South and had gone off to college from Pine Bluff, Arkansas in 1957, when Little Rock Central High School was integrated, they had lots of questions. I told them everything I remembered about that awful fall and how disgusting I thought it was. We stood and we stood and we stood. We snaked forward truly at a snail's pace. After hours, we could actually see the rotunda, and that gave us heart. Then the sun went down and it got cold, really cold. The night got blacker and colder and colder. To pass the time, we continued to talk to those around us and cry off and on, and not one person gave up and left. It was now approaching 9 p.m. My back was killing me as my whole frame was off center with the extra pounds of the baby, and I could no longer feel my feet. But we didn't dare give up any of our four spots. All in all, we were in line 9 hours. Finally, at 1 a.m., we got into the rotunda. I don't know what we expected. The first thing that hit us once we were in that actual space was the sweet, intoxicating scent of the thousands of roses and lilies that filled the room. And then we saw it. It was the most gorgeous casket I had ever seen, draped with a huge American flag. It all took my breath away, and I just gasped. Then the tears started. In a matter of 10 short steps, I reached the spectacular cherry wood box. I had never seen anything like it. Shiny brass rails gleamed down the sides, and we were allowed to move past it very, very slowly. The casket was surrounded by United States Marines, and the rotunda itself had more Marines standing at attention around the walls. It struck me that they had crisp white gloves on. The casket shone in that light as though it were a work of art, not a coffin that held our president. I suddenly had an overwhelming need to touch the coffin. We all must have felt it because that's what everyone did. It was such a personal way to say our private goodbyes as though it mattered. When I walked up to it, I slipped my hand under the flag, and I just for 1 second felt its magic. It was a holy experience. In a matter of 15 seconds, we were out on the other side. There was not to be one more second allowed to stand or pray, or certainly not to take a photo. It was just all so very sad and silent. The only sound was the click of the rifles of the Marines as they moved them from one shoulder to the other while standing as honor guards. Once we foregathered on the other side, there was nothing to say or do. We staggered back to the hotel and all fell into bed, trying to find sleep, with nothing but our silent feelings about what we had done and seen. The next day, the coffin was to be taken out of the rotunda, down Pennsylvania Avenue, and past the White House to its final resting place at Arlington National Cemetery. The four of us decided that I was to go and stay at the home of a Stanford classmate of Bob's and watch it with her on her TV while the three of them went to the final parade. Through the expert work of all the TV cameramen, I was able to watch their progress as they followed the cortege. The three of them actually saw John salute his father. They saw the riderless horse with the tall, gleaming black leather boots turned backward in the stirrups to symbolize a fallen warrior. Most of all, once the caisson passed them, they saw Mrs. Kennedy walking down the middle of the street, holding on to Bobby Kennedy. Her face was hidden in a thick black veil, thick enough that no one could see her, but she could see the hundreds of thousands lining every inch of the street all the way to Arlington National Cemetery. How would she or Caroline or John ever forget it? Once everything progressed from Pennsylvania Avenue toward Arlington, our little group met once again to make the long ride back home to New York City in silence. I will never forget it.
Kay Hunley Fisher, a Little Rock native, recently returned after a 50-year absence. Kay met and married her husband, Bob, in 1963, and among other things, he taught her to travel at the drop of a hat, learn, and experience our world with all its faults and glories. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.
I'm glad to be here singing to y'all tonight.
Well, 1,000 stars are out tonight. I do believe I'll pick one out for you. Yeah, and if it is a satellite, well, that's right, I'll pick one up brand new. Then I think I'll go inside, crawl back into bed tonight with you. With a sense of the world's a ride, right on to round old tight to you. Yeah, satellite. I wish I may and I wish I might, satellite. I wish I was a million miles from here tonight, satellite. Well, now it's Sunday morning, sunlight coming through the awning sky. Wake me up the coffee cup. You ask me what I wanna do. My mom's in the kitchen. My dad's playing his little radio. Low. The world is ours. Fields full of wires. Where do you wanna go? Yeah, satellite. I wish I may.
Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Audrey Dean Kelly? Did y'all like Audrey? Audrey? Audrey's self-titled CD can be found on iTunes, and more can be found out about Audrey at Reverb Nation and Facebook. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Our featured artist tonight is Little Rock painter Doug Norton with his JFK paintings here, his portraits. And this one over here is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this painting and Doug at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight is our second JFK show and coincides with JFK 50 Years Later, a photography exhibit showing at 8 venues throughout the Argenta Arts District that features rarely and never before seen images from the largest JFK archive in the world. Tonight's stories center around the personal way the writers will always be connected to JFK. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Deborah Carroll's schoolgirl crush is unwillingly tied to that fateful day. Then Sandra Hamilton's wounds link her to two historical dates. And we'll end the night with Tim Bennett, an image on TV, and a touching connection. But let's start the night with Mary Beck as her sighting of the man who would become president bonds to an unlikely event in Family Ties.
It was a cool September day in 1959 when my brother Don, my mom, baby sister Becky, Uncle Jim, and I piled into our 1950 Chevy and headed to Utah State Fair. I was 9 years old, Mom was driving, and we all talked about the cotton candy, hot dogs, and seeing a bearded lady and tattooed man, and other sights of interest of those times. It was a once-a-year outing. Little did we know we could have found bearded ladies and tattooed men every day in Southern California, but I digress. There was an air of excitement, and the fair was always crowded, but as we got closer and closer, we were surprised to see cars stacked up, double parked for miles. Mom just kept on going, not pulling over like all the other cars. We were making good time. Then a policeman ahead of us stopped her car and insisted Mom pull to the curb. Suddenly, sirens blared from behind and an escort of police cars and security chaperones roared down the street. It was loud. That was when I first heard the name of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Everyone with any Irish blood thought he was their rich cousin. In my family, coming from O'Connors, weren't any different. At that time, Kennedy was running in a primary to become the nominee of his party. I didn't know all that, being just 9 years old, but my mother did, and she liked this Kennedy, filled with wit, charm, good looks, and his gorgeous, glamorous wife, Jackie. "Look," Mom shouted, "there he is." Although obviously half of us were on one side of the car and half of us were on the other side, we all managed to smush over for a look at the handsome candidate. I saw a silhouette of a man, this Kennedy, going by. I'm not sure how much of a look I really got of him. The car went by pretty fast. I know this much, it was surely 1959 because Jackie was not with him. If Jackie had been there, my mother might have just been content to turn around and go back home, not bothering with the fair. For she was that kind of person, Jackie. When people saw her, they were content with that. But we just had Jack. And unfortunately, our car, 9 years old like me, was not as energetic as I was. Once stopped, the Chevy just wanted to take a break. For all the priming and cranking, the old gray mare just would not get up and go. My mom took her fun seriously, however, and she was determined that we were all going to have a great time. We got a tow truck to haul us to the fairgrounds, put baby Becky in her stroller, and stuffed our hungry faces with as much junk as we could find, and at a fair, that is a lot. It was in the days when girls all wore dresses all the time, basically. Did not matter if you're going to hang upside down like a monkey, you just had to figure out how to cover your panties. That made it very exasperating that early evening when every time I happened to walk over a ground grate, a burst of air would shoot up. Might have looked cool when Marilyn did it, but I tell you, it's no picnic when you're desperately looking for a restroom to have all that breezy stuff going on. Still, I was having fun, sort of, for me. The food and the rides were terrific. I like rides, and seldom, if ever, get car sick or anything like that. We were all chock full when my brother asked me to go with him on a parachute ride. It looked and sounded wonderful, and it was. Up in the air so high, the entire fairground spread out in bright stripes and triangles. We went spinning around, and on the way down, it was, well, what I imagine a parachute jump would be like. And all the excitement of seeing JFK, car failures, gooey food, and strange hairy beans, I'd forgotten something about my brother. This kid could not go three spins on a playground ride without upchucking. And yes, he did. Below us on a spiral stream, spun out in the target zone, and suddenly I'd had about as much fun as I could stand for a day. I'm sure other things happened. I don't remember anything else of note, but maybe that was enough for one day. For anyone anywhere, I had a glimpse into the future at the man who would stare down the Russians during the days we were all under our school desk. For all that, there's no way I can ever separate the experience of seeing the wonderful Mr. Kennedy, our rich cousin, from that of my brother on the parachute ride. Things just happen that way in families.
Born Mary Louise Laprise, Mary Beck says that says a lot about her. An artist in oils and ink and writer of many formats, her favorite genre is humorous shorts as long as they are laundered. In our next story, Deborah Carroll's connection to that fateful day is forever tied to another man's handsome face in Innocence Lost.
It was the fall of 1963, and one of the best parts of the seventh grade was Mr. Gunther, our science teacher. He looked just like Paladin, who was on Half Gun Will Travel. I always stared at him, wondering how he shaved that little dimple in his chin. Up until that point, all my teachers in elementary school had been women, mostly older women. So having a handsome man as my teacher was going to be really cool. I don't think I could have learned anything in that class because I saw his mouth moving, but I never heard the words. It didn't matter. I could stare at him for hours. And then came the morning of Friday, November 22nd. Things had really changed that year since starting junior high. The first thing I did was cut my waist-length hair so it went better with my Beatles look, with a red blazer and a black skinny tie. Never thought girls would want to dress like this, but it seems to work for those special occasions. We were finally getting used to riding a bus. We decided that walking several miles to Nichols' store to meet in the morning to catch the bus made a whole lot more sense than catching it at the end of the street. My favorite thing that year was Dr. Pepper with some cashews dropped in it and a moon pie. Some girl said it was supposed to make you feel sexy, but it never worked for me. I thought it would be cool to have my Uncle Jimmy being a coach at Southwest Junior High, but he didn't cut me any slack. All the kids were afraid of him because he walked around the school grounds with that paddle, hitting it on his right thigh because he knew he could use it. He broke up the last cat fight before the gym class. A couple of the girlhoods got in a fight in the hall over a guy, and I was rooting for Nora to win. She was cool for a hood. She kept getting in trouble for smoking behind the school. We were in gym class together, and I got to be friends with her so she could protect me when things got scary. Maybe our friendship was one-sided. I just thought she was my friend. Because she was older and in the 9th grade, I think maybe she got held back a couple of years. A group of us had been friends since the 1st grade, and now we got to ride the bus together all the way from Meadowcliff to Broadmoor. Ours was one of the first houses in the neighborhood. One day, Mom and Dad were clearing rocks out of the backyard. We had a creek that separated our property from the school property, and Daddy was chunking rocks over the new fence with the little cocker spaniels on the gate. He hit a wasp nest. Mom ran into the house, but Daddy kept running around and around the house because the wasps were chasing him. My two sisters and I were home, and we were laughing too hard to realize to be afraid for him. He finally was able to make it in the house, but he was stung pretty bad. So there I was on that Friday morning, elbows on my desk, hands on my chin, the smile on my face, staring at handsome Mr. Gunther as he sat on the edge of the desk talking to us. Then a voice came over the school intercom. It always announced things, and we usually didn't listen because it was just so stupid. But for some reason that day, the principal sounded different. Something was wrong. The president. Somebody has shot President Kennedy today in the parade in Dallas. My love-struck smile changed to shock. What? What did they say? Oh, no. What? Mr. Gunther stood up and he turned and he looked at the intercom over the blackboard. My heart sank as I watched the shock and pain and doubt and disbelief roll across his face like a storm. I felt my hand cover my mouth as Mr. Gunther's dimple just seemed to disappear. The president has been shot? I could hear people crying, and the loud beat of my heart throbbing in my ears, I just couldn't get beyond the shock. That handsome President Kennedy that all of us girls had a crush on. Shot? The first real politician other than Governor Faubus that I was aware of. Shot? How can that happen? On Friday, November 22nd, 1963, in my 7th grade science class, Southwest Junior High in Little Rock, Arkansas, with Mr. Gunther, my life and the way I looked at the world changed. It will be forever forged in my memory, watching Jackie Kennedy, a 34-year-old widow, climb out of the airplane. The flag-draped casket, and a little boy saluting in the parade. All the memories permeate my soul like the smell of popcorn makes me think of walking into a downtown theater. A time of innocence was gone with the flash of a rifle shot. The memories, always there, always there.
Deborah Carroll proudly claims Hot Springs, Little Rock, and North Little Rock as her hometowns. Although she's an award-winning author, artist, and sculptor, she dearly loves being a grandmother. Next, Sandra Hamilton's physical and emotional scars tie her to two different dates in Walking to Camelot.
The excitement grew as my high school's marching band played and the presidential helicopter touched down at the fairgrounds in Little Rock, Arkansas. In those innocent days of 1963, we were allowed to get amazingly close to the charismatic president, separated only by a chain-link fence. In just 2 short months, all of that would be forever changed. That day, afternoon classes were suspended. John F. Kennedy, the 35th president of the United States, was coming to visit our town, The majority of the student body walked to the fairgrounds to witness the brief stop that President Kennedy would make on a trip to dedicate a new dam system. Wanting to look my best, I wore my newest outfit and brand new leather shoes with no socks. The 1 mile walk soon had rubbed huge blisters on both of my feet. The school year at Little Rock Central High had barely begun on that September day. This was the same campus where President Eisenhower, just 6 years earlier, had sent in federal troops to force Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus to allow integration and to protect the 9 brave African-American students as they simply attended the all-white school. Racial tensions were still high in Little Rock, but the young, handsome 35th President of the United States was at the forefront of the civil rights movement, and for many of us, he was our hero. For others, change had come with resentment, but this was simply a rare opportunity to see the president. He was the first politician who didn't seem old to us and the first to address the youth in a way that made us feel valued and full of promise. His youthfulness made the 3 years that separated him from my dad seem like a whole generation. I stood there that day in the crowd of teenagers, my feet aching as I listened, spellbound, to the president's speech. Truth be told, I didn't really take in what he had to say. I was so giddy with the excitement of seeing this man in person that I could scarcely focus on his message. The glow of that special visit was still with me on November 22, 1963. The halls were filled with students banging locker doors and hurrying to class after lunch. As we neared classroom doors, teachers stood with somber faces, quietly sharing the news. The president has been shot. Come in and sit down. Surely, I thought, it must be just a wound in his arm or something, just a nick. He will recover. I noticed a handsome upperclassman that I had a crush on skipping down the hall in celebration of this horrific news, apparently in resentment of the president's commitment to racial harmony. Instantly, I felt nothing but repulsion for this once appealing young man. Mrs. Ryman hurried us into the geometry class, where we sat in stunned silence. Soon the announcement came over the static-laced intercom. Students, the President of the United States has died. Please rise for a moment of silence. I stood with wobbly knees in disbelief and looked out the window to the front lawn to watch as the U.S. flag was lowered to half-staff. We were later dismissed to the auditorium to watch the scant coverage of the confused aftermath on a television with rabbit ears. Thankfully, this awful event took place on a Friday so that we could be with our families for the weekend to absorb all that had happened. Church services were immediately scheduled throughout Little Rock. My sister came home from college, and we all attended a special service at our church. Bells tolled all over town. A few days later, we watched on TV as the world paid last respects to the president. Our hearts broke when the little boy saluted his father's coffin as it was carried down the street on the horse-drawn caisson. It was his third birthday. The little red scars rubbed by my brand new shoes on the walk to see President Kennedy on that autumn day would remain on my feet for decades. Often, I touched them, remembering all of the wounds.
Sandra Spotts Hamilton is a native of Little Rock who graduated from the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville with a degree in art education and a minor in English. She currently works as a designer and writer and still seeks Camelot. In our final story of the night, an image is seared into Tim Bennett's memory and along with it a connection in Father and Son.
I was only a child on November 22, 1963. What little I do recall was filtered through the mind of a five-year-old, where the letter K, as in JFK, would more likely stand for kindergarten than a politician's name. For me, it was finger paints, learning shapes and songs and playing games, toasted cheese sandwiches and Campbell's tomato soup, penny candy, playing outside, cartoons, and being excited when Dad came home. My dad was tall and thin back then, clad in shiny black dress shoes, black socks, woolen blend slacks with a thin leather belt, and a starched white shirt with a sharp skinny tie. He would come home each workday evening to a mini celebration of his arrival. If I greeted him first, it was me running to him, saying his parental honorific over and over again. And if he found me, he would greet me with dentine gum, a little compact oblong stick of cinnamon goodness. Dad was good at greetings and farewells. When he would put my brother and me to bed, we would beg him to carry us like he showed us how a fireman would. A variation on that was being carried like a sack of potatoes. We would giggle and laugh while he carried us all the way to the bunk beds in the front bedroom that we shared. "Sleep tight and don't let the bed bugs bite," he would say after depositing us on the beds. Dad had a pipe, glasses, and a spy novel, more often than not, on the end table by his easy chair in the den. He was not a morning person and was not to be trifled with before coffee. He really wasn't ever to be trifled with, and the foolishness of childhood sometimes clearly annoyed him. But he was there like the sun rose every morning, and Mom was his favorite person. There was security in knowing that. Years later, not much else seemed to be secure after that somewhat innocent time seemed to suddenly change that year. I remember school after the president's death. Our teacher, Mrs. Thompson, earnestly asked the group of boys and girls which of our mothers had cried that morning. All the kids raised their hands except me. "Timothy, didn't your mother cry this morning?" asked the teacher, somewhat surprised. She most likely had been seeking affirmation from the community via its children for her own grief, rather than any literal answer. "No," I answered truthfully. I hadn't seen my mother cry that morning. After class was out, I walked a few blocks down the sidewalk from our elementary school to our suburban home. I mentioned it to my mother. "Of course I cried this morning," my mother informed me. "You just didn't see me." In a household where anger and frustration were practically celebrated with various verbal permutations and voice levels going from irritation to ire, grief was different. It was often private, unshared. Years later, I realized my mother was also worried that the teacher would think that we were Goldwater Republicans. As my childhood continued, I experienced how America would work through her grief regarding the loss of her beloved president. I remember the shiny 50-cent pieces that came out with his face on them. I learned that some Mexican merchants loved to receive them in payment when tourists went shopping over the border in Tijuana. I saw a framed portrait of the man in someone's living room where Spanish was spoken. America's first Catholic president struck a chord with many different groups of people, but those who were in the faith seemed particularly devoted. Later, that portrait would be joined by those of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy in some homes. It was a strange time in which to be reared in America. Why did our leaders keep getting killed? More than one child must have asked. A few days later, after that particular kindergarten class, when I had noted my first view of our school flag at half-mast, I sat down with my dad and the rest of the family in front of our small black and white television. As I watched the somber funeral scene play out, our teenage neighbor and babysitter pointed out the president's son, John F. Kennedy Jr. "Look, there's John John," Carrie said, referring to him by his nickname. "He's your age." I saw the somber little boy in the dark, long, stiff coat with his mother at the caisson. I couldn't grasp the enormity of shock and sorrow that Americans were feeling at that time. But I did understand one thing then. A little boy had lost his daddy. Years later, I would learn that John John was 3 at the time, not 5, but it didn't matter. The image and the connection were seared into my memory. 30 years later, I would stand beside my father's casket in a private visit to the funeral home before the graveside ceremony. I would thank God for giving him to us and using him in my life, and I would give him back to God. And that's all that a son or a nation can do.
Tim Bennett has written for local and national publications. He teaches Spanish to high school students and writes poetry as well as creative nonfiction. He and his wife, Marla, live in Batesville, Arkansas. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.
This song's called The Roosevelt Hotel. I wrote it about a couple years ago when I was in college. I used to go out to this place in Los Angeles and have some crazy nights, and this is about one of those crazy nights.
Driving in a Mercedes, looking like an old lady. Lipstick lasts for days and months. Everything she wears is flashy. People call her nouveau trash. Wish that I could tell her just once. Tries to look like a soul.